She was doing everything right. That was the thing that made her so frustrated and so confused. She'd cleaned up her diet. She had cut out the obvious things, the processed foods, the sugars. She was exercising regularly, not obsessively, but consistently. She was going to bed at a reasonable hour. She'd lost a few pounds initially, but then the weight seemed to plateau, despite nothing changing. Her energy was erratic in a way she couldn't predict. She crashed in an afternoon, woke up tired even after 8 hours sleep. Her brain felt slower than it used to, foggier in a way that she had started to accept as inevitable. The cost of being in her early 40s, she assumed, the cost of a busy life. She had been to her GP twice in 2 years with these complaints. Her bloods had come back normal both times. She was told she was probably just tired, probably just a bit stressed, and was reassured that her thyroid was fine. When she came to me, we ran a different set of tests. We looked at her fasting glucose. We looked at her fasting insulin. But we also looked at her HOMAIR, which is a calculation that combines both to give a measure of insulin sensitivity. And she had significant insulin resistance. She'd almost certainly had it for several years, but nobody had really looked at it. Nobody had named it. Nobody had connected it to her fatigue, her brain fog, her weight plateau, her disrupted sleep, all the low mood that had been quietly building. And it was in the functional medicine assessment that we did with her that the central organizing driver of almost everything she had been experiencing came through as this insulin resistance. Welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, autoimmune and thyroid specialist, author of Optimal You, and founder of the Good Health Clinic. Welcome to April. So if you've been listening through March, you know that we had a solid foundation in that gut, immune, and adrenal triangle. Those three interconnected systems that underlie so much of chronic illness and that conventional medicine tends to address in isolation. This month, we're building on that foundation and going into a territory that I think is going to land really hard for a significant proportion of you, because it explains something that millions of people are experiencing and almost nobody is being told about. So this month, we're looking at metabolic health, inflammation, and the root causes that your GP maybe isn't connecting the dots with. And I want to start at what I consider the beginning of the metabolic story, insulin resistance. Because in my clinical experience, it is the single most common driver of the symptom cluster that brings people to me. So the fatigue, the brain fog, the weight that won't respond, the energy crashes, the poor sleep, the low mood, the sense that the body is working against you. These are not separate problems requiring separate solutions. In many cases, they are one metabolic problem with multiple expressions. And that problem is insulin resistance, usually present for years before it shows up in any standard testing. This episode is going to cover the full picture. What insulin resistance actually is at a cellular level, why standard testing misses it so consistently, what it does to the whole body as it progresses, why women in their 30s and 40s are disproportionately affected, even though it can affect anyone, and what functional medicine does to reverse it. It's one of the most scientifically rich episodes that I've recorded, and I've tried to make it as clinically direct as I can, because this information changes things when people have it. So let's jump in and start with the physiology. Let me start at the beginning, because I think insulin is one of the most misunderstood hormones in medicine. Understood primarily in the context of diabetes, which means most people don't think about it until a diagnosis arrives. And by then, the underlying dysfunction has typically been present for a decade or more. So insulin is a peptide hormone produced by the beta cells of the pancreas. Its primary job is to regulate blood glucose, to act as the key that opens the door on your cells, allowing glucose from the bloodstream to enter and be used for energy. So when we eat carbohydrates, glucose enters the bloodstream, the pancreas releases insulin, insulin binds to receptors on the surface of cells, and the glucose moves in. Blood sugar rises, insulin rises to manage it, and blood sugar falls back to baseline, and then the insulin falls. That's a healthy cycle. Insulin resistance is what happens when that key stops fitting the lock properly. So the cells, primarily muscle cells, liver cells, and fat cells, become less responsive to insulin's signal. The glucose cannot enter as efficiently. Blood sugar starts to rise. The pancreas responds by producing more insulin to compensate, essentially shouting louder to get the cells to respond. For a while, this compensation works. Blood sugar stays controlled, and you would never really know from a standard glucose test that anything was wrong. But behind the normal glucose reading, insulin is running at 2, 3, sometimes 4 times the level it should be, working overtime to maintain what looks like normal function. Now, what causes cells to become resistant to insulin in the first place? This is where the science becomes both fascinating and directly relevant to the lifestyle picture. The primary driver is chronic hyperinsulinemia. This is chronically elevated insulin. And what drives chronically elevated insulin? Diet high in refined carbohydrates and sugar. Every time blood sugar spikes sharply, as it does after refined carbohydrates or sugary food, insulin spikes in response. Do that repeatedly, multiple times a day, for years, and cells begin to downregulate their insulin receptors. They become, in a sense, desensitized by the constant noise. The signal that was once clear becomes kind of like background static. But diet is not the only driver, and this is clinically important because I see insulin resistance in patients with reasonably good diets who are confused about why their metabolic markers are off. Other significant contributors include things like chronic sleep deprivation. So even a few nights of poor sleep impairs insulin sensitivity measurably. Chronic stress and the cortisol glucose axis. That's directly relevant here. Physical inactivity. So muscle is the primary site of insulin-mediated glucose uptake, and low muscle mass or sedentary behavior reduces insulin sensitivity significantly. And then excess visceral fat. So that's the fat that is stored around the abdominal organs, which produces its own inflammatory cytokines. That directly impairs insulin signaling at a cellular level. There is one more driver that is worth naming specifically because it is profoundly underappreciated in clinical conversations about metabolic health, and that is fructose. So dietary fructose, particularly in the quantities delivered by things like high fructose corn syrup and the sugar content of processed food, is metabolized almost entirely in the liver, unlike glucose, which is distributed across all tissues. So large fructose loads rapidly overwhelm hepatic fructose metabolism. And this can really impact the liver converting fructose to fat and also the development of hepatic insulin resistance. The liver stops responding to insulin's signal to suppress glucose production. And this drives fasting glucose up and sets in motion one of the most metabolically damaging patterns that we see in clinic. What you need to hold from this section is that insulin resistance is a cellular level failure of insulin signaling. It's driven by dietary patterns, sleep disruption, chronic stress, physical inactivity, and that visceral adiposity that develops silently, often over a decade, while blood glucose can remain normal. The pancreas compensates until it can no longer keep up. And in that long silent window of compensation, the downstream consequences are already accumulating across every system in the body. If insulin resistance develops over years, and if its downstream consequences are so wide-ranging and so clinically significant, why does it so consistently go undetected in conventional medicine? The answer comes back to exactly what we discussed in March, the difference between what standard testing looks for and what functional medicine looks for. Standard NHS metabolic screening tests, fasting glucose, HbA1c, are a measure of average blood sugar over the preceding 2 or 3 months. And they're excellent tests for detecting things like diabetes or for monitoring glycemic control in people who already have a diagnosis. But they're not designed to detect insulin resistance in the compensated phase. So the phase that may last a decade or more, during which blood sugar is still being successfully managed by the pancreas at the cost of chronically elevated insulin. Fasting glucose becomes elevated only when the pancreatic compensation begins to fail. So when the beta cells, exhausted by years of overproduction, can no longer maintain normal blood sugar. That point is relatively late in the metabolic progression. By the time fasting glucose is flagged as impaired, a significant proportion of beta cell function has already been lost. And that metabolic damage of years of elevated, chronically elevated insulin is well established. HbA1c faces a similar limitation. It measures average blood sugar, which can remain within range, while you can have glucose spikes after eating. The sharp rises after meals that drive oxidative stress, inflammation, and endothelial damage are already significantly elevated. Standard screening does not capture these glucose spikes after eating. It takes a snapshot of the average and misses the peaks. Fasting insulin is the test that actually measures the hormone that is compensating to keep glucose normal. It's not always a standard part of the NHS metabolic screening, but it costs very little to add it on, so it's worth asking for. It is clinically straightforward to interpret. It would identify insulin resistance years before glucose testing does, but it's not offered routinely. And then we have the homeostatic model assessment of insulin resistance. So this is the HOMA-IR or HOMA-IR, which combines fasting insulin and fasting glucose into a single index. A value below 1 indicates high insulin sensitivity. Values between 1.5 and 2.5 suggest developing resistance. Above 2.5, we're looking at clinically significant insulin resistance. And above 4, which is where many people do sit by the time they first get this reading, represents substantial metabolic dysfunction that has typically been present for years. And none of this is visible in a standard blood panel. And then there is one additional marker that is worth mentioning here, the triglyceride to HDL ratio. In insulin-resistant individuals, triglycerides tend to be elevated, and HDL, that's one of your cholesterol readings, which is the protective lipoprotein, tends to be low. A triglyceride to HDL ratio is one of the most reliable proxy markers of insulin resistance available in the standard lipid panel. It's not a definitive test, but it is a signal that it's already available in most standard blood tests that you are having. It's quite often already been run, but hasn't been discussed in the context of insulin metabolism. The practical implication of all of this, if you have been told that your blood sugar is fine, your metabolic health may not be. If your fasting insulin has never been tested, you have an incomplete metabolic picture. If your triglycerides are trending up while your HDL is trending down, even within normal ranges, your body may already be signaling a metabolic shift that deserves clinical attention. Insulin resistance does not stay confined to the pancreas or the metabolic system. As it progresses, it has downstream consequences across every major organ system, which is why the clinical picture of unrecognized insulin resistance can look so different in different people. So let's run through some of the main ones. The brain and cognitive function. So the brain is the most energy demanding organ in the body, consuming approximately 20% of total energy, despite representing only 2% of body weight. The brain relies heavily on glucose for fuel, and insulin signaling plays a critical role in neuronal glucose uptake, synaptic function, and the regulation of neurotransmitters, including dopamine and serotonin. In insulin-resistant individuals, glucose delivery to neurons is impaired, even when blood glucose looks normal on the tests. And this is sometimes described as the brain energy crisis, and it maps directly to the cognitive symptoms that so many patients describe: the brain fog, the word-finding difficulties, the mental slowness, the reduced ability to concentrate that feels different from just tiredness. It is different. It is a cellular energy problem in the brain itself. There is a longer-term dimension to this that I consider one of the most important areas of emerging metabolic research. Alzheimer's disease is increasingly understood in metabolic terms. Some researchers have even proposed the term type 3 diabetes to describe the brain insulin resistance that underlies many cases of Alzheimer's. The epidemiological data is consistent. Type 2 diabetes approximately doubles the risk of Alzheimer's disease, and insulin resistance in midlife, even subclinical insulin resistance, is associated with measurably accelerated cognitive decline. And this is not a distant risk for someone in their 70s. It is a metabolic trajectory that begins in the 30s and 40s. Then we have energy production and mitochondrial function. Insulin resistance directly impairs mitochondrial function, the cellular energy production machinery that we covered in those March episodes of the podcast. In insulin-resistant cells, the signaling pathway that normally upregulates mitochondrial activity and promotes the biogenesis of new mitochondria is disrupted. The result is less efficient energy production, more reactive oxygen species, which is the damaging byproducts of cellular metabolism, and a progressive reduction in cellular energy output. This is the mechanistic explanation for fatigue that standard testing cannot explain. Patients with insulin resistance frequently describe exhaustion that is not proportional to their activity level or sleep quality, because the problem is not at the level of rest or activity. It is at the level of cellular energy production itself. The cells are not efficiently converting fuel to energy, so ATP output is reduced and you feel it as profound cellular tiredness that sleep doesn't fix. Then we have hormonal disruption, so specifically in women. Insulin is not solely a metabolic hormone. It is a powerful anabolic and endocrine signal that influences the production and regulation of your sex hormones. And this is where the disproportionate impact on women in their 30s and 40s becomes clear. Chronically elevated insulin stimulates the ovaries to produce androgens, specifically testosterone, and this is the central mechanism of polycystic ovary syndrome. PCOS is, in the majority of cases, an insulin-driven disorder. Not all cases, but in many, an insulin-driven disorder of androgen excess. The ovarian cysts are a downstream consequence of the insulin-driven hormonal disruption, not the primary pathology. Beyond PCOS, chronically elevated insulin suppresses sex hormone binding globulin, SHBG, which is the protein that carries estrogen and testosterone in the bloodstream and keeps them biologically inactive at the right concentration. When your SHBG falls, free estrogen and free testosterone rise, and this drives the estrogen dominance pattern that underlies so much of the perimenopausal symptomology. So you might experience mood instability, water retention, weight gain, specifically around the hips and the abdomen. Insulin resistance also impairs the conversion of cortisol in its inactive form of cortisone in adipose tissue, leading to elevated local cortisol activity, which further drives visceral fat accumulation, which further worsens insulin resistance, and that cycle becomes self-reinforcing. Then we have inflammation and the immune system. So visceral adipose tissue, so that's the fat that is stored around the abdominal organs that accumulates in insulin resistance, is not metabolically inert. It is an active endocrine and inflammatory organ. Visceral fat cells produce pro-inflammatory cytokines, including TNF-alpha, interleukin-6, and interleukin-1, the same inflammatory signals that drive autoimmune disease activity. They also produce adipokines, including leptin and resistin, which further impair insulin signaling and drive inflammatory activation. This creates a direct mechanistic link between insulin resistance and immune dysregulation. And we talked about this more in the March episodes, and we're going to discuss it more in next week's episode. Insulin resistance drives visceral adiposity, and that drives chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation in turn drives that immune dysregulation, which drives autoimmunity. They're not parallel stories. This is one story told in a sequence. Next, we have to look at sleep architecture. The relationship between insulin resistance and sleep disruption is bidirectional in a way that creates one of the most vicious cycles in metabolic medicine. We established earlier that sleep deprivation drives insulin resistance. The reverse is also true. Insulin resistance disrupts sleep architecture. Specifically, chronically elevated insulin impairs the normal nocturnal decline in glucose, which interferes with the deep sleep stages in which growth hormone is released and cellular repair occurs. Insulin resistance is associated with reduced slow-wave sleep, increased cortisol overnight, and the 2 to 4 a.m. waking pattern that so many of my patients describe, which is not simply stress, but a glucose and cortisol dysregulation occurring in those small hours. Then we have the one that most people do know about, which is cardiovascular risk. Chronically elevated insulin promotes sodium retention in the kidneys, driving blood pressure up. It stimulates the proliferation of smooth muscle cells in arterial walls, one of the early steps in plaque formation. It shifts the lipid profile with triglycerides up, HDL down, that's your protective cholesterol, and a shift towards the small, dense LDL particles that are significantly more damaging to the arterial walls than the HDL. This is why the cardiometabolic picture in insulin resistance is often missed by standard lipid testing. Total LDL may be normal, while the particle composition is profoundly out of balance. Advanced lipid testing, so looking at NMR lipoprofile or apolipoprotein B, is the way to see this, and it is rarely requested. I also want to spend a few minutes looking at something that I think is genuinely important and genuinely under-addressed in the metabolic conversation, which is why insulin resistance is so prevalent among women in their 30s and 40s specifically, and why this demographic is so consistently failed by standard metabolic screening. The first piece is hormonal. Estrogen is insulin sensitizing. It promotes glucose uptake in muscle tissue, it improves mitochondrial function and supports the maintenance of healthy body composition. When estrogen levels are optimal through the 20s and into the 30s, the body has a degree of natural protection against insulin resistance developing. But as estrogen begins to fluctuate and decline in perimenopause, which can begin as early as the mid-30s in some women, that protective effect diminishes. Insulin sensitivity worsens. The same dietary patterns that were metabolically tolerated at 32 may begin to drive metabolic dysfunction at 38 or 42. The body has not failed, the hormonal environment has changed. The second piece is the stress physiology. Cortisol and insulin are metabolic antagonists. Cortisol raises blood glucose, insulin lowers it. In a state of chronic HPA activation, the sustained stress load that characterizes the lives of many women in their 30s and 40s, managing careers, families, relationships, and often their own health without adequate support, cortisol is chronically elevated, which chronically drives blood sugar up, chronically requiring insulin to compensate. The HPA axis and the metabolic axis are not separate stories. They are the same story told through different hormones. And then the third piece is the diagnostic gap that we've covered briefly, which disproportionately affects this demographic because the symptoms of insulin resistance in women are easily attributed to other causes. So fatigue is attributed to a busy life. Brain fog is attributed to perimenopause or to stress. Weight gain that resists intervention is attributed to aging or to diet failures. Low mood to anxiety or depression. None of these are wrong as observations. They are genuinely stressful and demanding life stages, but they are also missing the picture of looking at metabolic signals. And the metabolic layer is consistently missed because it is not looked for. So what I want you to take from this section is one thing. If you're in your 30s or 40s, you're fatigued in a way that doesn't resolve, your weight is not responding to dietary effort, and your bloods have come back as normal, insulin resistance must be on that differential. You should be looking at it. Not as a certainty, but as a genuine clinical possibility that deserves to be fully investigated with the right tests. The absence of a raised fasting glucose does not mean the absence of a metabolic problem. So what actually moves the metabolic picture from a functional medicine approach? Insulin resistance is one of the most reversible metabolic conditions we manage in functional medicine. And this is not a qualified statement, it's a direct one. With the right dietary approach, the right movement strategy, the right nutritional support, and adequate sleep, insulin sensitivity can be meaningfully and measurably improved within weeks. This is one of the most well-replicated findings in metabolic research. So let's have a look at some of the main levers. The most powerful dietary lever for improving insulin sensitivity is reducing glycemic load, so the total glucose and insulin-stimulating impact of the diet. And this doesn't mean eliminating carbohydrates. It means replacing refined carbohydrates and added sugars with whole food carbohydrates that are paired with fiber, protein, and fats, all of which slow that glucose absorption and reduce the insulin response. The low-carbohydrate dietary approach has the strongest and most consistent evidence base for improving insulin sensitivity, reducing fasting insulin, and lowering that HOMA-IR. The mechanism is direct. Fewer dietary carbohydrates means less glucose load, means less insulin demand, and means reduced chronic elevated insulin levels, which means an improved insulin receptor sensitivity over time. And again, this doesn't mean not eating carbohydrates. Specific foods worth prioritizing are your non-starchy vegetables as a primary carbohydrate source, legumes for their combination of protein, fiber, and low glycemic index, berries over high sugar fruits, whole grains over refined grains, and the elimination of liquid calories from sugar and fruit juice, which deliver that glucose and fructose, but without any fiber that would slow their absorption. And the fructose piece is particularly important. The hepatic insulin resistance driven by that high fructose consumption, and we're talking about things like this high fructose syrups, that's one of the first things to address. Secondly, we need to look at protein. So protein at every meal. Dietary protein has a minimal insulin response relative to carbohydrates and simultaneously stimulates glucagon, which is a hormone that counteracts insulin and promotes glucose release from the liver when needed. Adequate protein at a meal, which is usually around 25 to 30 grams per meal, helps stabilize that post-meal glucose spike. It supports your hunger signals and is essential for maintaining and building the muscle mass that is the primary site of insulin-mediated glucose uptake. You cannot meaningfully improve insulin sensitivity without preserving or building muscle. Next, we need to look at movement, particularly things like resistance training and post-meal walking. Skeletal muscle is, as we've already said, the primary site of insulin-mediated glucose disposal. Muscle contraction drives glucose uptake through an insulin-dependent pathway, which means that exercise improves glucose clearance, even in insulin-resistant individuals whose insulin signaling is impaired. And this is clinically significant. Movement works on a separate pathway from insulin, providing a parallel route to metabolic improvement. Resistance training is particularly valuable because it builds that muscle mass and increases that total capacity for glucose disposal. And because the metabolic effect of a single resistance training session lasts 24 to 48 hours, it's even more important. A post-meal walk of even 10 to 15 minutes has also been shown in multiple trials to significantly blunt that post-meal glucose spike by using the glucose arriving from the meal in active muscle rather than allowing it to drive that insulin secretion. And this is one of the highest yield, lowest cost metabolic interventions available. We also need to look at sleep as a metabolic intervention. 6 nights of sleep restriction reduces insulin sensitivity by 30%. So sleep optimization is not a soft recommendation in the context of insulin resistance management. 7 to 9 hours of sleep with consistent sleep and wake times in a dark and cool environment with blue light limitation in the 2 hours before bed are all metabolic interventions, not just wellness preferences. The physiological mechanism is clear. Adequate sleep supports the overnight decline in cortisol that allows insulin sensitivity to reset, and it preserves the growth hormone secretion during deep sleep that drives lean tissue maintenance. Then we can look at some targeted nutritional support. So several nutrients have direct and well-researched roles in insulin signaling and glucose metabolism. Magnesium is required as a cofactor in over 300 enzymatic reactions, including insulin receptor activation. And magnesium deficiency is associated with insulin resistance in multiple studies. Chromium potentiates insulin's action at the receptor level and has evidence from multiple trials again for improving insulin sensitivity. Berberine, which is a plant alkaloid, has an extensive evidence base in the Chinese medicine literature and increasingly in Western metabolic research, and has been shown in meta-analysis to reduce fasting glucose, fasting insulin, and that HOMA-IR reading, comparably to metformin in some studies. Alpha-lipoic acid improves that mitochondrial glucose oxidation and has good evidence for improving insulin sensitivity. And then things like myo-inositol or d-chiro-inositol forms have become one of the most clinically valuable tools in my practice for women with insulin-driven hormonal disruption, particularly in things like PCOS. The evidence for inositol restoring insulin signaling, reducing androgen levels, and supporting ovulatory function in PCOS is now substantial, with multiple systematic reviews confirming its efficacy compared to placebo and comparable to metformin again for certain outcomes. So what I want you to take from this part is that insulin resistance is not a life sentence. It's a metabolic state that developed over time in response to specific outputs, dietary, lifestyle, stress-related, hormonal, and it responds to the removal of those things and the addition of metabolic support. The timeline for meaningful improvement is not years. In most of my patients, we see measurable changes in fasting insulin within 8 to 12 weeks of consistent dietary change, movement, sleep improvement, and nutritional support. And that's a pretty short timeline for what can feel like a very long-standing problem. So let me bring this back to the patient that I described at the start of this episode. She was doing everything right. She was exhausted, foggy, and stuck. Her bloods were normal. She had no explanation. Her numbers in her existing blood results were fine, but some of her readings were missing. And they explained at that mechanistic level when we did do them, almost everything that she had been experiencing. The afternoon crashes because her cells were struggling to efficiently convert glucose to ATP. The brain fog because her neurons were experiencing the same fuel delivery problem. The weight plateau despite dietary effort because chronically elevated insulin is powerfully anti-lipolytic. It actually suppresses fat burning. The disrupted sleep because her nocturnal glucose dynamics were dysregulated in exactly the way that insulin resistance predicts. The low mood because the dopamine and serotonin pathways are sensitive to the same insulin signaling disruptions that affected her energy metabolism. She wasn't broken, she wasn't failing. She had a metabolic condition that had been present for years, but had never been fully tested, and the pieces of the puzzle hadn't been pulled together. It was also entirely addressable. The question I'd like you to take away from this week's episode is, do you recognize the pattern that I've described today? The energy crashes, the brain fog, the weight that resists your efforts, the sleep that doesn't restore. If so, the question is not whether you are doing enough. The question is whether you've got the right metabolic picture. Have you had the right tests? Are you doing the right things? It's worth getting to know your numbers. So before we finish today's episode, the cardiometabolic pillar, including insulin resistance, blood sugar regulation, and metabolic drivers of energy and weight, is covered in full in my book, In Optimal You. If you want to understand your own metabolic picture and what to do about it, that's the starting point. And the link to grab a copy is in the show notes. The 7-day reset is also specifically designed to begin the metabolic work, the blood sugar stabilization, the reduction in dietary inflammatory load, nutritional support for insulin sensitivity in a single structured week at £7.99, also linked in the show notes. Next Monday, we're going to have a look at the metabolic roots of autoimmune and thyroid disease now that we've understood the metabolic picture. We'll build directly on today's episode and go into the connection between insulin resistance, inflammation, and immune dysfunction that underlies the conditions so many of my patients carry when they have things like Hashimoto's, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and the broader autoimmune spectrum. This is my clinical specialism, and it's one of the episodes I've most wanted to record. I'll see you on the next episode of the Good Health Podcast. You've been listening to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, autoimmune and thyroid specialist, and author of Optimal You. You can find me at goodhealth.uk, that's GOODE, on Instagram at Good Health Clinic, and wherever you get your podcasts. The show notes and all the resources are listed below. See you next week.